Gift ideas from local and national artisans in contemporary fine crafts such as paintings, photography, jewelry, pottery, wood, fiber, and more. Wind, Water, and Light, far from the ordinary, at 10 Main Street in downtown Champaign. Programming at WILL is made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and coffee bar.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. There's still time to trim your 2005 tax bill, but you want to do it very carefully. More about that in just a moment. Anyway, two tax experts from RSM McGladrey Incorporated in Champaign join us today for the Afternoon Magazine. I'm pleased to welcome back to the program Marty Verdick and John Breen. They're here to take your telephone calls about taxes. So if you'd like to join us, if you've got a question, here are the phone numbers. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Marty Verdick is a CPA. He is the Managing Director of Tax Services for RSM McGladrey Incorporated in Champaign. And John Breen is a manager with the Tax Department at RSM McGladrey in Champaign. Again, the phone number is 333-9455, 800-222-9455. That caveat I added at the first here at the outset was something that Marty mentioned as we were getting ready to go on the air. It's important that you take a look at your situation, right, Marty, before you rush into any last-minute decisions on where to trim your tax bill.
That's exactly right. It is very important to know what the starting point is, to decide whether or not it makes sense to do some of these planning strategies. I've had situations where someone might be in a very low tax bracket in 1 year and anticipate a much higher tax bracket in the following year. And so the normal strategies of accelerating deductions might not make sense in that case. They might save taxes at a 10% rate this year when alternatively they could have saved taxes at a 28% or higher rate next year. So the first thing I usually tell people when we talk about year-end planning is where are you now? Let's figure out what the starting point is and let's see what makes sense. It's a very good thing to do. The other thing to do right now is find out whether or not a person is protected from any underpayment penalties. If a person's income has gone up substantially, they might owe tax with their tax return when they file it in April of 2006. And if they didn't pay in enough tax on an ongoing basis during the course of the year, they may be subject to some underpayment penalties. And there are things that can be done between now and the end of the year that may minimize those penalties.
Okay, very good. We already have a listener.
Great.
Ready to talk with us. Caller in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. This is a question not about saving us taxes so much as potentially saving our daughter taxes next year for tax return filed in 2007.
Okay.
She is a senior in college, will be graduating this spring, and it's a private college, so there are some pretty substantial expenses out of our pocket. And we have been taking getting the lifetime learning credit from mm-hmm. them. Now, for tax year 2005, we've already maxed out the amount of credit we can get from it. And so for her last half payment, that is, the payment for the last half of the year for her, we thought we would not pay it to the college ourselves, but gift it to her and let her pay it, writing a check. That way she could get the lifetime learning credit for tax year 2006 and save taxes for that year. Now, my understanding is that the lifetime learning credit is only available to those who are dependent. Well, it's not available to dependents, but to who it's available to those who to whom they are dependent. So she would need to be financially independent.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
And how is that determined?
Well, there are a number of dependency tests that are specified by the code. For example, there is a gross income test. There is a support test. There is a relationship test. There are a series of those. The ones that typically cause people to either pass or fail the dependency test, the two most important ones in this case would be the support test and the income test. Essentially, if you provide more than half of her support for a particular year, and she is a full-time student for some portion of at least 5 months during that year, you're probably entitled to the dependency exemption, in which case she wouldn't be able to take the credit. Now, there are some rules where you can actually forego the exemption, but if she graduates in May, depending upon kind of what the rest of her year looks like, you may or may not provide more than half of her support. The education expenses would be considered in that support test. So you need to take a look at the standard dependency tests to see whether or not she is your dependent or not. But you're correct in that if she is a dependent of yours and you claim her as such on your tax return, she's not going to be eligible for that lifetime learning credit. It's something that you would claim on your tax return.
So if we gift her the money and let her pay it, we would be foregoing the possibility of the lifetime learning credit next year.
If you gift her the money and let her – now, it not necessarily. Again, you really have to take a look at who is providing the support, whether she would be eligible to claim herself as a dependent or whether she would be a dependent on your return. It just depends on where the money is coming from and how much you provide versus how much she earns during the year, since she's going to be hopefully entering the job market and the workforce.
So you're saying that even if we do give her the money and put it in her account and then let her write the check,
yeah,
after the beginning of the year, we might still be able to claim it?
It's possible.
I hadn't realized that. All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay. Next, we talk with a listener in Urbana, line two. Good afternoon. Hi.
I'm calling because I've never quite understood the rationale for retirees who were state employees who are allowed to deduct state sales taxes from their income tax. We do it, and I'm glad we do it, but I've never quite understood why.
Okay, I'll try and answer that. First, I'll restate the question so we all are talking about the same thing. Years ago, there was an itemized deduction that taxpayers were allowed for a sales tax deduction, and that sales tax deduction was allowed over and above any state income tax deduction. And you could do one of two things. You could either keep all of your receipts, or you could use a table provided by the IRS. That went away quite a few years ago, and it has recently returned. It returned, John, was it in 2004, I think, was the first year for that, or was it?
I think that's right.
Yeah, I think it was last year.
Yeah. Now, what the rule now says is that you can take the larger of the sales tax deduction as specified by the IRS or your state income tax deduction based upon the taxes that you actually pay during that year to your state of residency. And the sales tax deduction is calculated based upon a table provided by the IRS, and the more income you have, the presumption is the more you spend, and therefore the more sales tax deduction is allowed. And then you can add to that sales tax on certain high-ticket items like a car, boat, airplane, those kinds of things. Now, I think the focus of your question is, as a retiree, you may not pay much state income tax, since the state of Illinois does not tax your income. Is that
right?
Is that where you're heading with it?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So because of a law in the state of Illinois that says that they do not tax your retirement income, and that's true whether it's retirement income from a university pension or a private company pension. They just don't tax retirement income, period. Your state income tax deduction is generally quite low, and therefore, in your case, the sales tax deduction would generally be the larger of the two.
Yeah.
And you're allowed that deduction, and it's simply provided for in the code. Now, the way that one of the ways this came about was fairly strong lobbying from senators and representatives in states that do not have an income tax, such as Florida, Texas, South Dakota would be another one. Those states don't even have an income tax. So for a resident of Florida, they're obviously going to take the sales tax deduction because they don't have a state income tax deduction. It's just that because of the source of your income is not subject to tax in the state of Illinois, if it's primarily retirement income, you will generally take that state the sales tax deduction since it's going to be the larger of the two items.
Right. Thanks.
Okay?
Okay.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call. Other questions are invited. No one waiting at the moment. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. If you'd like to talk with our guests this afternoon, John Breen and Marty Verdick of RSM McGladrey Incorporated of Champaign. The toll-free number, if you're outside the Champaign-Urbana area, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Any significant changes to tax laws for this year?
Well, there are a number of changes, a couple of the most significant of which really came about as a result of part of a hurricane or a relief bill. And, John, you want to talk a little bit about the changes in the charitable contributions and the limitations that apply?
Yeah, that was probably one of the larger adjustments that was made. When Hurricane Katrina hit, I mean, obviously it had a big impact on, you know, New Orleans as well as, you know, all the rest of the country. And so there was a provision that was put into the law that you're now allowed to deduct up to 100% of your adjusted gross income as charitable contributions on your 2005 return. Now, there is a time frame, and those the contributions, I think, is it August 25th, Marty?
That's correct.
Somewhere
yep.
in there.
Yep.
Between August 25th, 2005, and before January 1st, 2006, you are allowed to deduct 100% of those contributions subject to your AGI limit. Prior to that, or for any contribution that you make prior to August 25th, that limitation would be 50%. So it does allow people who are anticipating, you know, giving some large charitable deductions, you know, perhaps over the next week or so, and if they were coming up against that 50% limit, this now gives them a little bit more of capacity to donate and save some tax. The other interesting thing about that is they don't have to be to a Hurricane Katrina fund. You can donate to any charity of your choice, and you still get that 100% limitation.
I guess that makes sense because a lot of charities all over the country and of all different kinds of stripes did some kind of hurricane relief work,
right?
Churches
right.
and the like.
To illustrate what that, to really put some numbers on that, let's assume that a person had income of $50,000. Normally, if they were to make cash donations in any particular tax year, their deductible charitable contribution for that year would be limited to 50% of $50,000 or $25,000. This particular rule says that they can take a deduction up to the full $50,000 of their income for contributions made between the August 25th and December 31st dates. If in the case of a non-cash contribution such as appreciated property like stock, that limitation previously was 30% of adjusted gross income. Again, now it's 100%. And one of the things that we generally encourage our clients to look at is if they are considering a large donation, rather than doing it with cash or check, some cash equivalent, if a person has appreciated property, such as stock, use that instead. The taxpayer still gets a full deduction equal to the fair market value, but they don't have to pay tax on the appreciation or gain. So let's say that we have stock that we paid $1,000 for that's worth $10,000 today, and we were thinking of making a $10,000 donation to the charity of our choice. We could either write a check for $10,000 or we could give the stock worth $10,000. Either way, the taxpayer is going to get the deduction for the $10,000, but by using the stock, we don't have to pay tax on that $9,000 of gain. The charity receives the stock, it sells it and converts it to cash. As a tax-exempt organization, they don't pay tax on it either. So it's a win-win situation.
Okay. Let's talk with another listener, caller in Champaign. Line one, hi.
Hi. I had a follow-up to the retiree and the sales tax deduction. Is there like a standard amount, or do you give your do you add up all your receipts, or how do you do that?
Well, the IRS provides a table that is used, and it is actually much more specific than the table that used to be years ago. The last time we had this provision, the table was by state. Now it's actually zip code specific, as I recall. It's very specific to where you live, and it uses your location of residence and your income to then calculate what the sales tax deduction would be. So you don't have to save your receipts and accumulate all of that. Instead, you merely go to the table that's provided in the instructions, and you can determine the amount of the standard sales tax deduction that you're entitled to.
I see. Okay, well, that's great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else, 800-222-9455. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. This afternoon, we're talking about taxes. Our guests are Marty Verdick and John Breen of RSM McGladrey Incorporated in Champaign. One thing that I have been reading about lately and hearing about is the alternative minimum tax. And as we're talking about deductions, one of the things that I've read is that this could hit you if you're not careful of your deduction preferences.
Correct.
What's this all about?
Well, alternative minimum tax is something that has been in the tax code for quite some time. When it initially was put into the code, it was designed to make sure that taxpayers paid some amount of tax, even if they were able to take advantage of provisions in the tax law that might have otherwise reduced their tax to a very low amount. So this provision has been in place for quite some time, but because of the decreased federal income tax rates that we see today compared to years ago when this came in, the tax rates in the alternative minimum tax didn't change. So as our federal tax calculation results in lower and lower regular tax, more and more people are being subjected to the alternative minimum tax. There are a few deductions which are allowable for regular tax purposes, which are not allowable for alternative minimum tax, or AMT as we call it. The biggest one that will catch people is the state and local tax deduction. So the deduction for your state income taxes, your sales tax, and your real estate taxes, while those deductions may reduce your regular tax liability, they are not deductible for alternative minimum tax. And that can result in someone owing this alternative minimum tax when they wouldn't have otherwise owed a regular tax. And the way the calculation is done is you calculate the regular tax and the alternative minimum tax, and you essentially pay the higher of the two. It is something that is routinely missed by people if they're preparing their own returns, so it's something to certainly watch out for. And it's something that if you miss it, it's really easy for the IRS to figure out that you've missed it, and they'll end up sending the taxpayer a notice. But the tax rates for the alternative minimum tax are 26% and 28%. Well, that's not that far off the maximum rates for individuals. And so for people that might be in a 28% bracket regularly that have a lot of these deductions, such as state and local taxes and real estate taxes, it is quite common for people to be caught by this alternative minimum tax that otherwise wouldn't have been. And there has been talk in Congress of making changes to this to either increase the exemption amount or even to do away with it completely, because it was designed originally to cause, you know, the so-called high-income, high-net-worth taxpayers to make sure they paid tax. Well, I'm seeing lots and lots of clients who certainly wouldn't consider themselves to be in that category that are being hit by the alternative minimum tax.
Yeah, it's something you don't want to get hit by.
Right.
Well, and from a planning opportunity, you know, a lot of times we'll run projections at the end of the year for our clients to determine, should we pay our fourth quarter state estimate in December of the current year, or should we pay it in January? And there are instances where AMT will tend to help us drive the answer one way or the other, because sometimes it's to a person's advantage to pay that state tax deduction in December and generate a deduction on the 05 return. But there will be other times where just the payment of that tax amount will put them into an AMT situation. And at that point, we'll advise them to wait until January to make the payment.
Yeah, interesting. Let's talk with another caller, a listener in Champaign, line one. Good afternoon.
You made a reference to variances in income. In 05, I had a big capital gain. I've had extra money withheld from my employer's withheld extra money. Is there a minimum or is there a measure that has to be met in order to avoid being penalized?
Yes, there is. John, you want to go ahead and take that?
Yeah. Generally, there's a couple things that you need to watch out for. As long as your adjusted gross income in the prior year was under $150,000, then what you need to do is make sure that your withholding or the combination of your withholding and your estimated payments for the current year is more than what your total tax was on last year's return. So, for instance, if let's say your tax liability last year before your withholding and estimated payments was $5,000. This year, you would want to make sure that you had $5,001 withheld in order to avoid penalties at the federal level. Now, if you have a higher adjusted gross income, something over $150,000, then you have to look at last year's tax and you multiply that by 110%. And then that becomes kind of your magic number for determining what you need to pay in for this year.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Other calls are invited, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455.
One thing I wanted to mention when we were talking about charitable contributions that it's a little bit different, and that is charitable mileage. When you drive your vehicle for charitable purposes, you're generally allowed a deduction for the charitable use. But that deduction is quite low. I think it's 12 cents or 14 cents a mile. However, if you drove in connection with Katrina relief, for example, if you made a trip taking supplies down to Mississippi or Louisiana, the IRS allows a deduction equal to 70% of the current business mileage rate, which the year ended, currently the business mileage rate is 48.5 cents a mile. 70% of that number is 34 cents a mile. So if a person did drive for Hurricane Katrina-related charitable work, such as driving supplies down, things like that, they are allowed a charitable contribution deduction equal to 34 cents a mile. And that can add up to be a pretty significant number.
Yeah. Well, back to the charitable deduction thing that we were talking about earlier, it seems to me that if you have a charity or charities in mind that you want to gift this year, this is a great year to do it because it's a really a win-win situation. Let's say now here I'm at the end of we're at the end of the year and I want to make an extra gift to the friends of WILL.
Sure.
Okay. So I'm going to march in to my friendly person who's on the other side of the building in development and say, Heather, here's my credit card number. I want to give the friends an extra gift this year. Now, I'm making the charge here at the end of December. The bill isn't going to show up until next month when I pay it. Does it count?
Yes, it does. There is a provision allowing you to pay charitable contributions and other types of things such as medical expenses by credit card and get the deduction in the year that you made the charge, not the year that you paid your credit card bill. Normally, for charitable contributions, what we tell people is that they have to make that payment this year. That means date the check this year. That means physically deliver the check to the charity or get it postmarked this year. The one kind of unusual twist is in the case of a credit card, I literally can call up on the morning of the 31st of December. Given it's a Saturday, it may be a little tricky this year, but you can call up the charity that morning, give them your credit card number, charge the contribution, and that is a deductible contribution for the 2005 tax year.
Okay.
Even though you might not pay it until January.
Okay. So you will have the documentation there. Back to the mileage thing. Do you have to have documentation?
You should have some type of documentation showing that you actually made this charitable trip. That can be something as simple as a log where I write down the mileage when I left, I write down the mileage when I return. It would be helpful to have some type of documentation such as fuel receipts just to prove that you actually made this trip, because otherwise how can you really prove that you left Champaign and drove to Louisiana with a carload of relief supplies if you don't keep some kind of evidence? It would be really nice if you could get some kind of acknowledgement from the charity that you're making this delivery for, where they actually give you a letter that says, yes, you did in fact make this trip.
Thanks, Marty. Okay, let's talk with another listener. Caller in Urbana, line one. Good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon. I have a fellowship this year, but they don't automatically take out taxes, and I haven't paid any estimated taxes. Is that a problem for me, or will I just be able to cover it when I report it in April?
Well, it depends on the character of this fellowship. There are certain types of scholarships and grants that may not be taxable to you. And it really depends on whether or not you're required to perform services in connection with this. It is not that uncommon to have a fellowship. Well, it is possible that fellowship may not be taxable. And without knowing the specific details of the fellowship, it's very difficult to answer that question with certainty.
Oh, okay.
But it is something that you would I would suggest contacting your department office or the payroll office, and they should have the details and be able to help you come to that conclusion as to whether or not it's taxable or non-taxable.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot. When I was in graduate school, it was very confusing. I had a measly stipend. and they insisted on taking taxes out of it, but there was a way to get it all back at the end.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and that's going to depend. In the case of a graduate school stipend, the dollar amount may be low enough that you may not actually be subject to tax if that was your only source of income. Your total tax may be low enough, and if that's the case, if they did take taxes out, you could then file a tax return and get a refund of the taxes withheld. There was actually an opportunity on your W-4 form, which is the form that you fill out when you get a job, that you can mark that you are exempt from withholding. You would do that because you have to make the representation that you do not expect to owe any tax liability because of the level of your income, and then they're not going to withhold the taxes and you don't have to wait to get them back.
Yeah. Boy, I wish I'd known that all those years ago because it was hard.
And you just had to wait for that refund.
Every penny counted.
Every dollar does count at that point.
333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area if you've got a tax question for our guests this afternoon, Marty Burdick or John Breen. And if you're outside the Champaign-Urbana area, you can use the toll-free line. Won't cost you anything. 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Caller in Savoy, line one. Hi.
Hello. He was just talking about the federal reimbursement for mileage, and it's currently set at 48.5. The state of Illinois is currently reimbursing its employees who travel at the rate of 40.5 cents a mile. So can state employees take an 8-cent deduction from September to December for all the miles they have traveled?
The answer to that is yes. The question is whether or not it will actually do you any good, and let me explain why. This mileage deduction would be claimed as part of your employee business expense deduction, which fits into the category of miscellaneous itemized deductions. So you would be allowed to compute an employee business expense deduction equal to the spread between the allowable rate of 48.5 cents a mile and the reimbursement rate of 40.5 cents a mile, so an 8-cent a mile difference. But once you do that, you take all of your employee business expenses and you include them in your miscellaneous itemized deduction, which is then subject to a 2% threshold, or a haircut as I'll call it, equal to 2% of your adjusted gross income. So if you had $100,000 of adjusted gross income, the first $2,000 of that category of itemized deductions will not provide you any tax benefit whatsoever. So while, yes, you can go through the calculation, it may or may not provide you with a tax benefit.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay. While we're on the subject of mileage and cars, can you get a deduction if you buy a hybrid?
Well, there is actually a credit, and John, that's changing. You want to address that, John?
Or? Yeah, actually, the way that it's worked in the past up until now, it has to be a qualified vehicle. And what happens is the government will issue kind of throughout the year which vehicles are on this list that qualify. And up to the end of 2005, there basically was a deduction for that, and I believe the maximum was $2,000.
I think that's right.
Whereas in 2006, what's going to happen is if it's a qualified vehicle, and again, this is one of those that the government has said it qualifies as the appropriate type of hybrid, there's actually going to be a credit that's available. And the difference between a deduction and a credit is that the $2,000 amount basically comes off of your adjusted gross income prior to figuring the tax, whereas the credit is a dollar-for-dollar reduction in your tax. So, for instance, if you were in a 15% bracket and you got a $2,000 deduction, that would be a $300 tax savings. As opposed to, you know, if you could take a $500 credit for, you know, buying one of these vehicles, then that's going to be a better result to the taxpayer. Marty and I were kind of talking about this on the way over here, and probably the way that most people will know whether or not the vehicle qualifies is that your salesman will point that out to you.
They're very quick to use that, yeah. as they should.
Yeah.
There are a couple of other things that people should be thinking about between now and the end of the year. Many people have flexible spending accounts at work where they are able to set aside dollars on a pre-tax basis to cover medical expenses. The problem with most of those plans is it's use it or lose it. If you set aside $3,000 into your flex spending account for medical purposes and you only spend $2,500, that extra $500 is gone. So in the last 10 days of the year, I would encourage people that have these flex spending accounts to take a look at where they are compared to their total set aside. And if they're going to be short, is there anything they need to be doing from a medical standpoint between now and the end of the year? Maybe they need new glasses. Maybe they would like to get prescription sunglasses. There's not a lot of time left. You probably can't, you know, if you thought about having a checkup, it's probably a little late to get in to see your doctor. But do take a look at that. Now, there are a couple of things that are a little bit different. It is no longer required that medications be prescription medications to be reimbursable under these flex spending accounts. If it is a non-prescription medication that is used to treat a medical condition, that can be reimbursed out of the flex spending account. The other thing that people need to understand is there has been a change in the rule. It used to be that December 31st was the drop-dead date. Use it by then or it's gone. That date has been extended to March 15th now. So you actually have until the 15th of March of the following year to use the money if your employer's plan has been amended to allow for that. A lot of employers' plans have not been amended. So you may have heard about this March 15th date and, oh, I don't have to spend it before the end of the year. That's only true if your employer's plan, the sponsor of this flex spending account, has amended their plan to allow that extra time and they are not required to do so. I know of a number of employers who chose not to amend because it just increased the administrative headache. Figuring out these expenses that were incurred in February, did the employee really want them reimbursed out of last year's money or this year's money? And they just said, you know, we don't want to deal with that. The other thing that people can do, most people have a mortgage payment that is due sometime around the first of the month or the middle of the month. Well, by simply making that mortgage payment this month rather than making it next month. So by accelerating the payment by maybe a week, you get the deduction for the mortgage interest expense attributable to that payment a full year early. If you make that payment in December versus, say, January 3rd or 4th, the 1098 statement that you're going to get from the lender is going to reflect that extra payment of interest expense so that you can essentially capture an extra month. Now, the first time you do that, you may actually end up getting then 13 months of interest payment as a deduction on your tax return. If you've been doing that all along, you need to keep doing it just so you keep getting 12 months of interest. If you don't do it, you're only going to get 11 months of interest, and that won't feel very good.
Okay, let's talk with another listener, a caller in Charleston on line one. Hi.
Hi. I had loaned my own political campaign money a year ago, and you know, that was able to repay that. Is that something that can be written off?
No. Years ago, there was a deduction or actually a credit for political contributions. That's been gone for quite a while. So no, that would just be a personal expenditure.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Next, we talk with a listener in Dwight on line four. Hi.
Oh, hi. I just had a question about taking money out of a variable annuity before age 59 and a half.
Mm-hmm.
There's a 10% penalty, and then you pay taxes you also pay taxes on the amount. Is the basis of what you pay taxes on excluding or including the 10% penalty?
Well, you will pay tax on the amount that is reported to you as taxable income on the Form 1099-R that you'll get from the annuity company.
Yeah, so I haven't decided whether to do this yet or not.
The
question is, how do I estimate it?
Well, let's throw a number on it and say that you're going to take out $10,000.
Right, okay.
And let's assume out of that $10,000, $7,000 of that is going to be taxable, because not all of it will necessarily be taxable.
The amount which you put in isn't.
Right. The penalty will be based upon the taxable portion.
Yeah.
And the interest, or sorry, the tax will be based upon that as well. So you do pay, you don't get to deduct the penalty in computing the taxable amount, if I think that's your question.
Oh, yeah, that was my question.
Yep.
Okay. No, so it's the full, let's make it simple. $10,000 you take out, you pay $1,000 penalty, and then you pay the tax on the full $10,000.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Next, we talk with a listener in Danville. Hi.
Hello. Does that provision of charging something work the opposite way? If I have very low medical expenses this year, but I broke my glasses, I do need some to replace them, and I have a 30% discount that will expire December 31st, so I thought the other day I could get my new glasses, charge them, and then deduct it when I pay for them in January.
Mm-hmm.
Does that work? I mean, you mentioned for Celeste and the charitable contribution.
Well, the answer would generally be no.
Okay.
You're deemed to have made the payment when you charge it.
I see.
Now, if you could get the glasses this year, you should take advantage of your discount and have the provider bill you, and you write them the check on January 1st or January 2nd, that would work. The fact that the services were performed in 05 doesn't control the timing of the deduction. It's when you pay for the services, either by check, cash, or credit card. So if you could convince your provider to give you the glasses and the discount this year, and you write them a check next, you know, the week after, the first week of January, then you would get the deduction in the 2006 tax year.
Or even order them, you know, have them fitted in December and have them delivered in January.
Absolutely, that would work too. Just don't pay for them until January.
Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome.
And would it also be okay if you were there and you wrote your provider the check and you dated it January 1st?
That gets a little dicier. Okay. I would say generally I would
play
try to
rules.
Avoid post-dating checks.
Okay.
That's not something you want to get into.
All right. But, you know, it would be a sign to the provider that I do mean to pay you for this. So, you know, okay. All right. Other questions are invited, 333-9455, the number to call in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else, 800-222-9455. Our guests this afternoon, Marty Verdick, he's a CPA, he's the Managing Director of Tax Services for RSM McGladrey Incorporated in Champaign. John Breen is with us, he is a manager with the tax department at RSM McGladrey, also in Champaign. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We've got about 6-7 minutes left in this portion of the program. Well, let's talk about retirement plans and IRAs. Those are things that people can look at and can easily manage to do in the last few days of the year.
Mm-hmm.
What are the
mm-hmm.
rules?
Well, there are that's a very broad question because there are so many different types of retirement plans. Generally, with an IRA, there are a number of different types of IRAs that a person could choose to use. There are traditional deductible IRAs, there are traditional non-deductible IRAs, and there are Roth IRAs. The choice between a traditional deductible and a traditional non-deductible IRA is really dictated by a person's coverage in another retirement plan and their income. Generally, if a person has retirement plan coverage at their place of employment and if they have income that exceeds a threshold, and it's not that high of a threshold, they are usually not permitted to claim a deductible IRA contribution. Now, they may still want to fund an IRA, but they will not get any current tax benefit for it, and that moves us then into the traditional non-deductible IRA. The advantage of doing a non-deductible versus not doing anything at all is that the money is then being put into a fund which will grow on a tax-deferred basis. With an IRA, you don't pay tax on the income as it's earned. You pay tax when you take the money out. A Roth IRA is a very, very attractive option for people. And the younger, the better. You are sacrificing deductibility. However, what happens is that when you take that money out of a Roth IRA at some point in the future, 100% of the money that comes out, assuming you keep it in there till normal retirement age, is taken out on a tax-free basis. So all of the gain that occurs between now and, let's say, 40 years from now for a 25-year-old escapes tax completely. There are some income limitations. If your income, again, exceeds certain thresholds, you're not permitted to have a Roth, you're not permitted to fund a Roth IRA. You can have one from earlier years, but you can't fund it for the current year. The nice thing about IRAs is basically you have up until the due date of the tax return to fund them. So you don't have to worry about it until April. In the case of a self-employed person, most self-employed retirement plans, or many of them, have to be established before the end of the year. So if a person has self-employment income and is interested in establishing a retirement plan based upon that self-employment income, they need to move pretty quickly and in most cases get that established between now and December 31st, and then they can fund it based upon their earnings for the year.
Okay. We've got a number of folks now waiting to talk with us. Let's go next to Wheatfield, Indiana, line 4. Hi.
Good afternoon. I have a question concerning a farm depreciation deduction. Is there an advantage to trading a like-kind piece of farm machinery over having the dealer buy your trade?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's definitely a tax deferral advantage with that. Actually, Marty is our like-kind exchange expert, but I'll kind of give you a nutshell, and we'll let Marty jump in here if I get my facts messed up a little bit. But for the most part, what you're allowed to do is you take your equipment. Let's say you have a tractor that you want to trade in on a newer tractor with the dealer.
Right.
What the dealer will do is he will give you a trade-in value on that, and then ultimately what happens is you do not have to pay any tax on receiving that trade-in value. And then you then get to depreciate the difference that you pay, sometimes called boot, that you pay over and above that trade-in value. So you set that up and depreciate that, in essence, as a new asset.
Right.
If you went to sell that to the dealer, the problem that you have is you now have to pay tax on the gain from the sale of that asset. And what happens is you take whatever you originally paid for that tractor. Let's say it was $50,000. Let's say you've depreciated $20,000 of that. So now that you have a cost basis of 30, if he gives you 40 as a sales price, you now recognize a gain of $10,000.
Yes.
Whereas if you had traded that in, that gain piece would be deferred until you actually sell the asset that you're trading for.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there are two issues that come up. By selling it and then buying the new property outright, you are getting a higher depreciation deduction.
That's what I was thinking.
But it comes at a cost, because to get that higher depreciation deduction, you're paying tax on the gain. And generally, that doesn't make sense to do that. Now, there is another twist in all of this, and it's a sales tax twist. If you trade in a piece of property in Illinois, and I believe it's the same in Indiana, you are only paying sales tax on the net cash paid. So if you buy a $70,000 asset, cost 70, you trade in something, and using John's example, they give you a $40,000 trade-in allowance, so you pay $30,000 cash. You generally only pay sales tax on the $30,000. If you sell that piece of equipment to the dealer outright and then write a check for the full $70,000 purchase price, you're going to pay sales tax on the full $70,000. So that's another reason that the trade-in or like-kind exchange is advantageous for you.
I thought that you might be helped by selling the piece of equipment. If, for example, you're going to use the whole piece for Section 179 deduction, and if you did that, you would thereby reduce your self-employment tax also.
Generally, it's not going to work out to your advantage.
Okay. All righty. That's
okay.
The question. Yep, thanks.
Okay. You're welcome.
Next we talk, we'll take one more call here this afternoon. Line 1, Champagne. Good afternoon.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Well, I don't have all the stuff in front of me, but... My question is, I rent my basement, and part of the time, whenever I have a tenant, and I take off depreciation. And my question is about depreciation. I always come out with a loss because my income isn't that much, because I don't charge that much, and I don't rent that much. But usually the depreciation comes out of, I go by a chart that's in the income tax book. But, and it always, it's about the same each year. Is that right? And at what point does it change?
Well, the depreciation on real property is a straight line depreciation, which means that it will result in the same depreciation deduction. Assuming that the property hasn't changed, you are going to get the same depreciation deduction each year.
Okay. It goes on, there's no time?
It goes on. In the case of residential property, it's a 27-and-a-half-year life. So it's going to go on for a long time.
Oh, so I don't have to be concerned about that.
Probably not.
Just take the same amount each year.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay. Thank you for the call. Made some people happy this afternoon, I think.
Good.
Thank you, the two of you, very much, and I hope you'll come back again before it's all the shouting and hollering is all over.
Sure. We'll be happy to come back again during tax season and answer questions.
Okay. Marty Burdick and John Breen have been our guests this afternoon. Both are with the RSM McGladrey Incorporated in Champaign. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Settlement prices are in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. On the Board of Trade this afternoon, after a big up day in the bean pit yesterday, there was some follow-through buying today, and then she traded off just a bit this afternoon, anywhere in ending up between 3.25 cents lower in the nearby January's. The March were off 4 cents, and next year's November beans were off 4 as well. We'll get to those numbers in completion in just a moment. We'll start at the Kansas City Board of Trade this afternoon. March contract there in the wheat pit, 376 the high, the low at 370. The hard red winter wheat March contract settled at 374.5, and it was up 3.5 for the day. July futures up 4.25, 63.25 the settlement price, the high at 65, the low at 360.5. March wheat futures now 329, the high, the low at 24, settlement price at $3.28. They were up 4.75 at the soft red winter wheat Chicago Board of Trade pit. May futures 338.25, the high, the low at 34, settlement price at $3.37.25. Up 5.25 for the day. July future contract 347.5, the high, the low at 343. July wheat, your harvest month, settled at 346.75, up a nickel in the September's, 355.75, settlement price up 5.5. The high at 55.75, the low at 51.5. And December futures, 367.5, the high, the low at 362.5. Dease wheat settled 365.75. They were up a nickel for the day. March corn futures, $2.12, the high, the low at 208.25. Settled a penny higher today at 209.75. May contract up one as well, 218.75, the final price for the day, the high at 20.5, the low at 17.5. And July contract, 229.25, the high, low at 226.25, settlement price there at 227.25. They were half higher. September futures, 237.5, the high, the low at 35, settlement price at $2.35.75, up 3/4. And the December contract in the corn pit, 248, the high, the low at 45.25. The harvest month, December for 2006, settled at 246.25, up 0.75. The March futures were up 0.75 for 2007. At 253.75, the high there at 54.5, the low at 52.5. Oat futures now, the March contract 189.75, settlement price down 4.75 for the day, had a high of 94 and a low at 89.5. And the May futures, a 190.5 high, low at 189, settlement price at $1.89 even, down 2 cents for the March, or rather May, oats. From the soy complex, January beans rallied to $6.15 today, but fell back to $6.04.25 before settling at $6.05.25 today, down 3.25 cents for the January soybeans. And the March contract, 627.5, the high, the low at 615.5, settled 616.5. They were off 4 cents today in the May futures. 635 the high, the low at 25, settlement price at 26. They were down 2.25. July contract in the soybean pit, 641 the high, the low at 31.5, settled at 632.5, a lot closer to the bottom end in that 9.5 cent trading range. They were down 2 cents for the day. August future, 640 the high, the low at 632, settled on the bottom at 632. They were off, or rather up 3 cents today. And the September futures, 637.5 high, low at 629. Settlement price at 629. They were off a half. And November contract down 4 cents at 634.25, with a high of 41 and a low at 32. January bean meal, $201 even. The high, the low at 196.80. Settlement price at 197.80. They were off 80 cents today. March futures down 60 cents at 198.60, with the high at 202 and a low at $198. January bean oil futures at 21.90, the high, the low at 21.28. Bean oil settled the nearby contract at 21.31. They were off 26 in the March. Bean oil settled 21.54, down 37, with a high of 22.20 and a low at 21.45. I'll return at 6 after the hour, 2 o'clock this afternoon, with the closing market report. That's just a few minutes away, when we'll talk with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities out of New Market, Indiana. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Okay, Todd, livestock contracts finished higher again today. January feeder cattle, 115.30, the high, the low 114.50, the settlement 115.05, that up 47 and a half. March feeder cattle, 114.90, the high 114.15, the low, the settlement 114.75, that up 67 and a half. April feeder cattle, 114.50, the high 113.40, the low, finishing at 114.42.5, that up 85. December live cattle, 96.65, the high 95.80, the low, the settlement 96.62.5, that up 85. February live cattle, 97.40, the high, the low 96.82.5, finishing at 97.27.5, up 47.5. February lean hog, 65.70, the high 64.85, the low 65.15, the settlement, that up 60. April, 68.10, the high 67.50, the low, the settlement 67.80, that up 52.5. May, 69.90, the high 69.22.5, the low, the settlement 69.72.5, that up 50. June lean hog, 71.60, the high, the low 71 even, the settlement 71.50, that up 60. February bellies, today's high 84.65. The low today for February bellies, 83.40. The settlement, 84.17.5, that up 55. The Dow is off 22 points, 10,814. The NASDAQ up 2 at 22.24. The S&P 500 up a fraction at 1260.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Renee Brown used to make $20,000 a year. Now she makes more than three times that.
I mean, I come from someone who used to work at a fast food joint. I mean, you don't make much money there, and there's definitely no insurance, so to me, it was like winning the lottery.
She's making Toyota Camrys, and she's non-union. How Toyota keeps its workers happy, that's today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered airs this afternoon at 4 Central Time here on AM 580.
It's 1 minute before 2 o'clock. Coming up this afternoon on The World, U.S. Marine Nathaniel Hill patrols with Iraqi soldiers. He lives with Iraqi soldiers, and he fights alongside them. Some of his fellow Marines think he's wasting his time. This afternoon on The World, we'll hear why he believes training Iraqi